Tyler Boudreau's a 12-year veteran of the Marine Corps Infantry. In 2004, he was deployed to Iraq for a tour of duty in an infantry battalion. Following that deployment, Boudreau was assigned as the commanding officer of a rifle company. While preparing to return to Iraq, he resigned his commission because of reservations over the legitimacy of the war. He writes about his experiences in his book Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. And Strange Champs asked Boudreau if he was against the war from the start.
Well, there was some ambiguous feelings about it for sure. I wasn't completely sold on the invasion, but I had been in the Marine Corps for 10 years at that point, and there was a part of me that very much wanted to go to war, whatever the war, just to test my mettle and to, you know, sort of justify my existence. I mean, I was a captain at that point, and there were a lot of guys who had been to various conflicts around, and I had not, just sort of coincidentally, even though I had been in the infantry the entire time I was in the Marine Corps. So there was a part of me that wanted to go, and all I needed was some sort of justification. And when they sort of shifted gears, you know, away from the weapons of mass destruction and to a liberation of Iraqi people and helping Iraqi people, that to me was satisfactory. So I said, well, okay, in this case, I'll go and I'll try to help. And this way here, I can also, you know, perhaps get into a few fights, and this will, you know, sort of serve that craving that I've had to get into combat.
At least at the beginning, there was actually some exhilaration, some pleasure in some of the firefights. I mean, you write about one of the first big firefights you were in. There's a story you tell about Lutafia.
That's right. Lutafia was a town south of our base, and it was very hostile towards American forces. And whenever we had forces down there, they were sure to get hit in one way or the other, whether by sniper fire, an RPG, or an IED, which is these roadside bombs. And we had sort of this growing and escalating series of battles. And so on, I think it was the second or third day of this escalation, I was traveling down with, you know, a detachment of the battalion down this road called Route Jackson. It was sort of the main road from Mamadia, which was north, to Lutafia, south. And there was a pretty significant ambush in place, and they were on both sides of the road, and there was just a lot of fire, a heavy volume of fire and RPGs and whatnot. And so we, you know, sort of went through that. And
you write about it that, you know, you all emerged unscathed, and at the end of it, you sound joyful, like you guys are dancing around and hugging each other and really excited.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So this is what I'm talking about with, you know, a combination of the adrenaline of having survived, first of all, with, you know, you almost get sort of a sport feeling to it. And the fact that nobody got killed really kind of, you know, made it almost, you know, perpetuated the fantasy of war being not that bad in the moment.
So contrast that to, you know, fast forward a few years, and there's a chapter you write called, I think it's called One Death Too Many.
Mm.
By then, you had a totally different take on death and killing. Do you want to tell me about the One Death Too Many?
Well, the thing that I did during my deployment was gather trends. This is what we as officers are sort of trained to do, is to watch for trends and not make, you know, rash decisions on one or two incidents. And so I had my doubts about certain elements of the war, and, you know, but I wanted to give it a fair shake, if you will. And I watched as the operations unfolded, and I always kept in the back of my mind the mission at hand, which was to help Iraqi people and to befriend Iraqi people. This was sort of a no uncertain terms kind of mission statement. There was very little ambiguity about that. And where it became ambiguous was, how do we go about helping the Iraqi people? Because we can't tell the difference between those who are trying to hurt us and those who need to be helped. And one of the problems we had on a routine basis was this Route Jackson, which was always littered with these IEDs, like I said, the roadside bombs. And we couldn't figure out what to do about it. Every time we drove down the road, a bomb went off. And, of course, the way they get the bombs on the side of the road is they dig a hole and they put a bomb inside and then they cover it back up again. So what happened was that anybody carrying a shovel became labeled a threat and was open to be shot. So there was many occasions, and one in particular to remember, but this was sort of a frequent occasion where snipers were out on the ground and they were trying to find these guys digging holes in the ground for IEDs, and they would call me up and they'd say, you know, we've got this guy on the side of the road with a shovel, and they would request permission to engage this individual, meaning they wanted to shoot him. And, you know, they were, say, you know, 100, 200, 300 meters away from this individual with a shovel on the side of the road, and it seemed like a very unambiguous situation, except for the fact that in Iraq, many people farm at night because of the heat and because of the electrical situation. A lot of the irrigation systems were only working at night. And we knew this after a while, but the problem is that every time you asked an Iraqi, you know, whether he was a farmer or a terrorist, they would always say they were a farmer. And it got to be where we would get frustrated and started to assume that everybody we spoke to was lying. And then after a while, we just stopped asking and we would just open fire on anybody with a shovel. And of course, after the fact, I started to think about that and said, well, gee, you know, I don't think that it's possible to guess right 100% of the time, which means that I had to have guessed wrong some of those times, at least once. And that means that I approved and authorized somebody, you know, a farmer getting shot, and I was not happy about that.
So you had been trained by the Marines to admire the killer inside you, you know, to find the killer inside you and then to feel proud of him. Eventually, it sounds like you became sickened by the killer inside you.
Well, yeah, that's right. They do want you to be proud of and sort of harness that killer inside you. It's true, but it's attached to a noble cause. It's always attached to a noble cause. And as long as you have that noble cause, fighting for freedom, democracy, the security of our nation, those sorts of things, defending the Constitution, then it makes sense and it's okay, I guess. You know, I mean, if you are literally defending our, you know, hearth and home and those sorts of things, then it makes more sense. It's when the mission becomes unclear or maybe, you know, you're not sure that the mission is quite just. That's when all that killing comes to the forefront and you really start to notice how terrible it is.
Mm. So you served in the Marine Corps for more than 12 years. And then after serving 1 year in Iraq, you wound up resigning your commission. Mm. Why?
I came to a point where I just no longer felt like we were fulfilling the mission that we'd gone to do. And as a commander, which I was a rifle company commander, that's not acceptable. You have to love your mission more than you love your Marines or your soldiers. And what I mean is that you have to be willing to sacrifice the lives of your men for the mission. You know, if there's a road that has to be traveled, then you've got to send those Marines down the road. If there's a hill that's got to be taken or a beachhead that's got to be taken or whatever the objective is, you know that it's going to cost lives. And so, in other words, you must love that mission more than you love your Marines. And there came to be a point where the reverse was true, where I loved my Marines more than the mission. And so I deemed myself ineligible to command any further and had to resign.
Is there any part of you that feels guilty, as though you betrayed your fellow Marines? I mean, a big part of the Marines' sort of raison d'etre is all about loyalty to each other.
I think that it would have been, in a way, disloyal to stay on and fake it, because by faking it, I could very well have cost lives that otherwise would not have been lost by being unsure or by hesitation or whatever might have unfolded had I gone to Iraq being unsure.
Do you still believe in war?
I don't rule out armed conflict because I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. But I am at the same time suspicious of many of the operations that the United States has initiated in the past and present.
Is there any part of you also that still misses war?
No. No, not at all.
Tyler Boudreau talking with Anne Strangechamps. Boudreau is the author of Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine.